Welcome to Tech Nation Health, reimagining the future of health and healthcare with the emergence of new technologies. Today I'm speaking with Dr. Marshall Summer. He's the director of the Rare Disease Institute and chief of genetics and metabolism at Children's National Health System in Washington, D.C. He's also a professor of genetic medicine and pediatrics at George Washington University Medical Center. With rare diseases, we often turn to genetics. I asked Dr. Summer, in the United States, how widespread is genetic testing in newborns?
What I'd say is right now there's about maybe 5 to 8 states that are starting to use very rudimentary DNA sequencing. Most of them are for immune disorders like SCID, but not widespread yet. And everyone keeps talking about it, and everybody keeps saying, gee, let's just sequence all the DNA and deal with it. But you know, you're going to get 5,000 variants per child, a lot of which you're not going to know what to do with.
Maybe okay.
So yeah, the answer will always be yes. You have something. I don't know what it means, but you have something.
You have something.
Yeah.
And yet, I was reading in some of your literature, over 7,000 rare diseases affecting some 25 million Americans.
Right.
That's basically 1 in 10, 1 in 9.
Yeah. Well, I guess the way to put it is every survey you do, what's always the most common grouping? It's always other. Rare disease is the other of the medical world. So individually, not so many patients. But when you do have 7,000, it hits those big numbers pretty fast.
Now, when a baby is born, is it obvious if there's a genetic disorder or not?
About a quarter of the time. So about a quarter of the diseases leave some physical manifestation. Down syndrome's the most classic people would think of. You know, they have facial features and physical features that are recognizable. You know, other patients will have things that may affect, you know, fingers, toes, things like that. A lot of them, though, aren't so obvious, particularly the biochemical disorders, the disorders that may affect the development of the brain. So a lot of them won't show up right away. That's one of the reasons newborn screening was so important for the biochemical disorders, because otherwise you'd just miss them until the patient got sick.
Well, I was noting that you have 13 clinical geneticists, 12 genetic counselors, and 2 biochemical nutritionists.
Correct.
What is a biochemical nutritionist?
So it's someone who's done their basic training in nutrition and dietary management. So in other words, they're the folks that know how to calculate what is in your diet, what is, you know, what are the protein contents, what's the basic molecular, and then take that and put it on steroids, not literally.
figuratively.
So, right. So our head of our program has her PhD in this very topic from University of Wisconsin, and then her number 2 has a master's degree in that. So they have taken nutrition out to the very edge of the envelope and then gone beyond that.
Well, give us an example. Let's say you don't produce a particular enzyme. Let's say how do you have to match the food to that?
Let's take the classic. Let's take the sort of what everyone uses as the prototype biochemical disorder, which is PKU or phenylketonuria. That's one we've been screening for 50 years now. The treatment is basically dietary. So the only source your body gets of the amino acid phenylalanine, which is the toxin in this disease, is from the diet. You can't make phenylalanine on your own, but you've also, in this disease, have lost the ability to break down the phenylalanine you take in. So the way the diet is managed in this is the amount of phenylalanine in every protein that goes into that patient is carefully calculated. They know what each type of food has from not just how much protein it has, but how much of each amino acid it has in it. We know exactly how much it takes for a patient to grow and develop normally, because you got to have some. But they also know how much they can give before that patient exceeds their capacity to break it down. Now it gets complicated because each patient has a little bit different capacity. Some patients you can give more, some you can give less. So if you give too much, a bad thing happens. The brain gets damaged. If you give too little, a bad thing happens. The brain doesn't grow when the brain is damaged. So it's like walking a tightrope. That's the simplest one. It actually gets more complex. There's another condition called maple syrup urine disease, which, in spite of the fun-sounding name, is not a fun disease at all. In that one, there are 3 amino acids you can't break down. So you have to run this juggling act with sort of like 3 chainsaws, because you have to keep each of those amino acids just enough to grow the baby, to feed the baby, and throughout life, But too much, you go too far, and then suddenly they're sick. So from the standpoint, what I would say is our dietitians and nutritionists, and most of them are start off as RDs, would say this is sort of the Super Bowl of nutritional management, is trying to manage these patients.
So it's not a medicine. What it is literally getting what they need through food, and you know, have to know the biochemical makeup of just about everything.
Correct. We call it nutraceuticals. So it's sort of, it's not a pharmaceutical. It's not standard nutrition, which is eat your vegetables and, you know, not too much fat, not too much this or that. This is literally breaking down food into its biochemical components and working it from there.
And they
really
start
fun.
As babies.
Yes.
And they're constantly changing and growing and doing that. And pretty soon they go to school. Who knows what's going to happen there?
Well, actually, what we know is a lot of times they don't do their diet. So that's teenagers are, like in the field of diabetes, actually, adolescents with diabetes are hard to manage. Adolescents with these biochemical disorders are hard to manage.
Now, did I see this correctly? Like some 8,000 patients go through your clinic a year?
This last year, about 8,500. So we're currently, as far as we know, the highest volume clinic around. So we've,
and
at least in North America.
And these are all kinds of disorders.
Yeah, we see a big chunk of all I think the last count, 7,500 different rare diseases. The count keeps changing because we keep discovering new ones within this sort of genomic era here. But we'll see a fraction of those every year in our patients.
Now, you have to diagnose these.
Correct.
That's got to be tough.
You know, interesting, the most frustrating part of the job is often getting to the right diagnosis. There's a concept called the diagnostic odyssey. There's some data out of Europe a couple years ago that may shed a little light on this. They looked at 8 different rare diseases that were kind of across the spectrum of how they presented. And what they found is a quarter of patients took more than 6 or 7 years to be diagnosed. Almost all of them had been given a wrong diagnosis at some point. You know, everyone likes to refer to, you know, these TV shows where the brilliant physician goes the aha and makes, brilliant diagnosis, and then everything goes forward. And what happens in reality is it's a hit or miss thing. You know, someone will have an idea. Everybody gets excited. It doesn't pan out. They go on to the next idea. One of the things we're really working a lot on is trying, we call it the diagnostic odyssey. We're trying to reduce that, and we're trying to use a combination of things. One is obviously sequencing, which still gives
you
some...
What is your DNA?
Yeah, but still can give you a pretty vague answer. But we're also trying to find some creative ways to apply particularly digital technology. So looking at different companies, and I won't name any by brand, but ones that have developed expert systems for assimilating large quantities of data, which we're dealing with here across all these diseases. And then instead of working forward for what's going to happen, these things actually work much better. So if you know where you ended up and you have some data on the different starting points, you can start to put together patterns so that when a patient presents, we'd like to be able to say, okay, the least path to get to the diagnosis involves going ahead and doing this, this, and this. Applying those and seeing if we can't get the diagnosis sooner. The patients do better. If there's a therapy available, then they can get under therapy faster. And it cuts down on the frustration and fear for these families. That's some of the toughest situations I see these families that are still searching for answers for their kids.
All these kids probably have pediatricians all over the United States, if not all over the world. How do those pediatricians have a chance at guessing what the heck is wrong?
They don't. And to
That's
be, to be blunt, there are some incredibly bright physicians out there in general practice. I'm married to one of them, so I have to definitely throw in a plug for pediatricians. Yeah. But what I've found is in a general pediatrics practice, you are seeing literally thousands of patients during a year. Trying to pick out which of those patients has an unusual condition, and then furthermore going on figuring out exactly what it is, that's a big task. So what we try to do is we try to provide tools for pediatricians on how do you identify the ones that aren't fitting the norm, and then get them into the system so we can try to figure it out. And we work very closely. We do, in the field of clinical genetics, just or rare disease, for instance, there are very few physicians right now. There's probably under 500 dysmorphologists, people who see things like Down syndrome. For the biochemical diseases, we probably have under 100 physicians in the field right now at a time when the diagnostic rates and everything are exploding. So The old model where, you know, you have the docs spread evenly across your geographic areas and you do, you know, your classic appointments, things like that, the wait times for most genetics practices are over 7 or 8 months. We've been able to reduce ours just because we have a lot more docs, but we're looking at things where we can get in early. So one thing we worked on developing was a phone app. So a physician who's seeing a patient and they're not sure what's going on, they have a relationship with us, they can take a few pictures of that patient. It comes into us, and what we'll do is give them an opinion on if we need to get this patient in quick, if there's something else that needs to be done, like go ahead and get an echocardiogram of this child's heart, go ahead and get an x-ray of this. So instead of the classic model, you wait, you come in, I say, well, now go get these tests and then come back in a month and then we'll go through that. We're trying to shave months off of that time. And it also helps out with kind of a triage system so we can get the patients that really need to get in fast and fast, the ones that we can take a little bit longer to work on, do it that way. And then we just did something really fun recently, working with Dr. Marius Lingararu at Children's National. He is an insanely good programmer, and we had the idea there are some genetic conditions that you can recognize by facial picture, Down syndrome being one.
Yeah.
And so what we did is we started taking collections of pictures from patients with different syndromes. And to my surprise, actually, for Down syndrome, for instance, the software is about 98-99% accurate off of a photograph from a smartphone, which is about as good as a clinical geneticist will do. And then we took the next one to George syndrome, and now we're kind of running down the line there for these. So we're trying to put the tools in the hands of the docs out in the community so if nothing else, then get started. And then we did one version of this that was basically normal, not normal. So you see a child and you kind of go, wonder if something might be going on there. And you can take a picture and it'll give you a probability on what might or might not be going on with that kid.
If they're fit in the norm.
Yeah.
It's all data.
A lot of it is. But I got to tell you, at the end of the day, the human touch is still important because when you start working with a family and you tell them something's going on, something's not right here, that's you need to be there with them when you're doing that, at least as much as you can. And that's also where we try to pull the pediatricians in because they usually have a relationship with the family. They know them. But that's still the hard part of the job.
It is. Well, with all of this effort, with all of this activity, you finally came together and formed a Rare Disease Institute.
Yes, we did. Well, in some ways it's looking ahead and in some ways it's a little retro. Let me explain what I mean. When I started in this field back in the 1980s in clinical genetics and metabolism, really all we saw were rare diseases. And then we had the whole genomic era. We started mapping all of these common diseases. And what I can say right now, I can't walk into any lab in any university and there's not somebody playing with DNA in there. So in many ways, the field of genetics became the field synonymous with the field of medicine. But we still had this huge group of patients with these rare medical conditions who need a medical home. We're diagnosing them in unprecedented numbers. So one of the things we realized is our clinical practice was based around these patients, but we hadn't really defined it. So that's where the idea for the Rare Disease Institute came out. So we sat down with the National Organization for Rare Disorders, NORD, which is the omnibus organization for all the patient advocacy groups. They have about 300 member organizations. They literally represent, I believe, millions of patients at this point in that overview, and said, okay, what can we do to provide a medical home where they can get consistent, predictable care? A place, you know, I hate to use it, a place where everybody knows your name, but a place where when you go to, they've heard of your disease before, they know what's going on, they're working on developing the best clinical standards for care. And that's what led to us forming the Rare Disease Institute. So we built a nucleus around our clinical genetics program and then have taken it kind of to this next level. And it focuses on a couple of things. One is what we talked about before, the diagnostic odyssey, shortening the time between symptom presentation and actual diagnosis. And not only should that happen inside our Rare Disease Institute, but it should also happen when the physician first notices something's going wrong or the family first notices something is going wrong. They should be able to get into a pathway that's going to get them there quickly. The other thing is treatment standards.
You're making it up as you go. How can there be a standard? Remember that one,
well,
two,
it's a little better than that, Mark.
Okay.
It feels like that some days. What I can tell you is there are pretty well established protocols for treating patients for only a handful of diseases. And here I'm going to borrow from my friends in the cystic fibrosis field. They're, I think, still the gold standard for how to do this properly. So when the CF Foundation started building their clinical centers of excellence, one of the things they realized is everybody was doing things differently. So they started pulling together what everyone thought was their best stuff, tried to pull it into a comprehensive or at least a consistent clinical protocol, and then started applying that. And then you start testing it. You say, okay, is this working? Is that working? All right, we noticed that the patients at site A are doing much better than the patients at site B. What's different about the two? And that's what we're going to try to do for over 7,000 conditions. The CF Foundation's actually helping us out with that. They've been willing to share their secret sauce, for which I will happily give them a great shout-out, and I'm very grateful for. But what we're doing is creating an open protocol system so that physicians, families, nutritionists, genetic counselors, you name it, who are working with these patients can access them freely and openly, but also comment upon what happened. Because what will happen is, well, I did this part, and then the patient didn't respond this. They responded this way. And so it gives you sort of a living document that you can continuously improve, continuously refine, realizing that some of the stuff you've got in there is wrong. I mean, I've been in the field of rare disease long enough to know that what I thought I knew in the early 1990s or late 1980s is not the same as how I treat a patient now. And these will have to be evolutionary documents, which is a little different from what you see in other fields of medicine. So one of my observations would be is rare disease really is emerging as a distinct field of medicine. And a couple of things about that that sort of makes sense. If I'm studying hypertension, I can pull data from literally tens of millions of patients. If I'm studying adult onset diabetes, same thing. So my guidelines, my statistics are all based on large population sizes. You know, there's these old grading systems for statistics, A, B, C, and D. You know, A is huge meta studies of multiple large centers. B is huge large center studies. C is usually published case series. In rare disease, we're always at the D level, which tends to be...
Yeah.
I've often heard it referred to as eminence-based medicine instead of evidence-based medicine. But what you have to do is you pull together the physicians who've worked with these patients the most. You get what they think is their best. You pull it together, and then you start using that, but you test it. And it's got to be out there where people can see. And that's for some medical groups, that's actually not the easiest thing in the world. You don't want necessarily people looking to see how you're doing. You know, maybe your patients aren't doing well as in other site. And, of course, it's always my patients are sicker than theirs or things like that. But it requires a fair amount of self-examination, a fair amount of park your ego at the door, and then you have to be able to play nice with others. So rare disease is starting to emerge, I would say, as a distinct field of medicine in that regard. And you look at drug approvals, you look at clinical trials, you look at all the different things we do in rare disease, you have to use small population size statistics. I can think of one disease I've worked with where we were testing a therapy on it, and we... we're able to draw our conclusions, but with only five patients, which if you're out and you're, you know, looking at general studies, you'd be appalled by that.
Yes.
But there were literally only five patients in the continental North America. So that was it. Literally, that was, instead of being a representative sample, that was actually a population study for those. So you have to think very differently about these rare diseases. The old magic p-value of 0.05 for probability kind of just goes out the window sometimes.
And, you know, the broad strokes that used to have to happen in my family, a portion of it picked up from New York and moved to Florida because of one of the members' medical condition, and that was like the only thing they could think to do.
Right.
And it didn't help that much anyway, but it was like there was such a loss.
Well, it's, and that in rare disease, one of the things we've seen commonly over the years is, well, my child has disease X, say it's a urea cycle disorder, take whatever one you want. I'm going to have to move to this city because the only person that knows anything about taking care of this disease is in that city. So we used to see a lot of geographic rearrangement based on that. And that's tough for the families. It's tough on the kids, and it's not always necessarily the best way to do things. So one of the things we're trying to focus on with this Rare Disease Institute model is trying to take care of people in place. And with modern technology, you really should be able to do that much better than we used to. I mean, some of the limitations still come around billing and things like that, but you know what? We'll save that for another discussion another day. But there's no reason why you can't use telepresence to find out how a patient is doing. We've spent a fair amount of effort on developing in-home diagnostic testing. So if you have, for instance, phenylketonuria, a disease where you can't break down phenylalanine, we talked about an at-home phenylalanine monitor. So instead of having to drive 3-4 hours into a hospital that can test it, and there aren't that many, you can instead test it at home, get on the phone with your biochemical nutritionist and your doc, and then not have to come into a children's hospital or a specialty hospital for adults, which are even rarer for these things.
Now I'm going to ask you three questions all at once, so you answer it any order you'd like.
All right, fair enough.
If you're a person out there with a family member with a genetic disorder, if you are a doctor and you want to know more, if you're a donor, potential donor, you have so much money you just don't know what to do with it, but you want to give it all these guys because they're working really hard. How do all those people access what's going on now?
Okay. Well, let's start with the patient and the family. That's the heart of the matter to begin with. There are a couple of good resources. One is the National Organization for Rare Disorders. They have literally information sheets.
NORD.
Yeah, they're easy to find on the web. They have literally information on almost every single rare condition that's designed around a patient consumer. They also have pretty good links to where these groups are organized, so you can find folks in the same boat you're in. Because one of the loneliest things I've seen are families who have been given one of these rare disease diagnoses and they feel like they have no one to talk to. And they talk to us as physicians, but we haven't walked the path they've walked. So one of the things NORD does is they connect them with people who've walked that same path. And you'd be amazed the power of that for these families. The other thing they have is usable information that family can then take to their physician, because they may have made the diagnosis, but maybe the physician doesn't have so much experience. And that can provide guidance on where to connect to get best care, what maybe is known about taking care of those families, things like that. The next is, let's now take it to the physician level. The NIH has spent a lot of effort on pulling together information around rare diseases. There's some excellent digital tools for that. I wouldn't say that the diagnostic part is quite where we want it yet. I think that's one of our big pushes the next few years, is to give them really powerful diagnostic tools. So my patient presents with this. Here's where we're going to go. But as far as getting information on these, there's a lot of stuff out there. You know, Dr. Google, which I hate to use that term, but can hook you up with a lot of those different resources. So there's some very good ones at NIH and some of the major medical centers. The other thing is, don't go alone into the woods. If you have a patient with one of these rare diseases, communication is your key. Find the person who wrote the article on that. And they'll usually answer your email. Find them, call them, bug them, say, I have a patient with this, I need help, or I need to send them to you for care. And what you'll find is people will respond, people will reach back. And so they don't have to be alone either. Because as lonely as it is for the parents, it actually can be kind of lonely for the docs too sometimes when they're trying to make tough decisions. I'll be happy to put up our web address for those donors with way too much money who want to be involved in that. And actually, that's one of the keys. Rare disease care, it's not really procedure-based. It doesn't fit a lot of the classic models. Most medical centers tend to run these programs at a loss. Our Rare Disease Institute, we provide, like I said, excellent care for these 8,000-plus patients. But it's, you got to make ends meet. So if I were going to invest my donor dollars, one thing I would do is in the systems that work on developing the clinical protocols. That's one place. And we got to have a standard one. So we really kind of need one system for that, which we're working on. I would also look at, you know, improving that diagnostic path. You know, make it shorter, make it faster. And probably there's a lot of efforts that can be brought to that. It may not be one answer. It may be several answers for that. And then also providing backup for families who just can't make the ends meet anymore. One of the things we try to do is create a testing fund. If we have a family we're trying to do testing for and the family's insurance won't cover it and they don't have the means to do that, we try to scrap and scrabble and find ways to get that covered so that family can get the diagnosis they need to move forward. So there's lots of places that they can help.
We'll not only put the link with your interview, I promise to put it prominently. So anybody comes out to our Tech Nation page, they'll go, there, I remember that. And yeah, go on
here.
It's
very gracious of you. Thank you.
Well, we'll do some good here, I hope. We'll do some good.
So diagnostics will be a big area, particularly starting to use smart technology. So that's one of the areas where I think there's a lot to be gained. And I think digital technology is getting to the point where that's really going to be very useful for us. If you can play Jeopardy and play chess, you can play rare disease. So potentials for therapeutics around genetics, the technologies. The other thing that's kind of coming along that people don't think about as much are cellular technologies, and not so much as a therapy, but for understanding. So different groups are now taking cells from the patients and using those to better understand the disease. You can convert skin cells back into stem cells and then create other tissues. It's not quite as good as the original, but you can make neural cells, you can make liver cells. And the level it's at right now, you can't really use that therapeutically. But what you can use it for is to actually look at that cell in very clean conditions and say, what does it do with this disease? And sometimes understanding the basic molecular basis for a disease is the first step to really coming up with a clever treatment for it. So that's another big area for me.
Oh, you got nothing to do.
No.
Just, nah.
No, I can honestly say I think I've got good job security.
Yeah, I think you do. Marshall, always a pleasure. Please come back. See us anytime.
Delighted to. Thank you so much, Mara.
Dr. Marshall Summer is the director of the Rare Disease Institute and chief of genetics and metabolism at Children's National Health System in Washington, D.C. Dr. Summer is also a professor of genetic medicine and pediatrics at George Washington University Medical Center. More information is available at childrensnational.org, then search for Rare Disease Institute, or on technation.com, where you'll find a direct link. For TechNation Health, I'm Moira Gunn.
TechNation and its regular segment BioTechNation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Mahler, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. TechNation and BioTechNation are productions of TechNation Media. I'm Paul Landcore.